Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We are simply surrounded by media in our time and history. We've got all the old media forms around us, plus all the things the internet and just being connected to other people provides. We take a regular overview of recent happenings in the media in our Signals and Noise segment. This month we have a regular and a pinch hitter. Eric Palmer is the regular professor in communication at Southern Oregon University. Welcome back, Eric.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And Mike Green, Jefferson Exchange co-host and media observer, is in the other chair this month. Mike, good to have you.
Thank you.
Start us off. Let's talk first about the back-to-back weekends of major presidential news, the shooting of former President Trump, and then the withdrawal on the following weekend of current President Biden from the race, and the ability of news organizations to cover. What's your initial hit on all this, Eric?
I think the main thing that has emerged just in the last 24 hours is a very interesting circumstance that the former White House photographer Pete Souza has relied on recently published photographs to call into question the extent of the injury that Trump might have suffered during the attack. And literally, like almost a minute the event happened, I knew that there was going to be kind of a moment like this where we'd be interested in relying on photographic evidence to try to determine what was going on with the state of Trump's ear. And so now that has kind of erupted into a little bit of a mini controversy that has also entangled the New York Times photographer, Doug Mills, who made one of the photographs that Souza was relying on. I personally think, you know, based on available evidence, I think the official account is probably correct that Trump was either grazed by a bullet or grazed by some shrapnel in the incident. But I also think we don't have it yet, but I do think that there will at some point will emerge conclusive, trustworthy photographic evidence that helps us know for sure. And I look forward to seeing that happen pretty soon.
Eric, it does seem like there was a certain amount of pressure, certainly coming from left-wing sites and entities that were saying the media need to be asking tougher questions about the Trump shooting and ask for official medical records. Do you think they were kind of in awe of the whole, you know, Trump with the fist raised and the blood running down his face picture and the reaction to that?
I don't. In precisely the way that you framed it, I do think that, you know, in the conventional world, it would serve Trump's interest to provide conclusive medical information. He chooses not to do that. You know, fairly persistently, he chooses not to be transparent in areas where I think it would be helpful both for the public and for him to be more transparent. And I think that the larger media will eventually get there. I think the reconstructions of the event, for example, that the New York Times has been assembling recently are super interesting and helpful. But I think it's also part of the nature of the times and the nature of Trump that it takes longer to get there. And it'd be, I think, nice if we could get that kind of clarity and transparency more quickly.
Signals and Noise on the Jefferson Exchange with Eric Palmer and Mike Green in the other chair this month. Mike, give us your take on what you've seen with this explosion of news on the presidential front in the last 10 days.
Well, I'm looking at a split screen here. On one side, you've got all these weird things that are happening with the Republican Party and Trump. And on the other side, you have the power of social media. And what I mean by that, I'm going to throw some numbers out at you. Within hours of Biden bowing out and tossing his endorsement behind Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris, the grassroots organizations took over, and they grabbed the media attention. More than 40,000 women on Sunday jumped on Zoom, and they called themselves Win with Black Women, and they raised more than $1.5 million for Kamala. And the very next day, 53,000 Black men, Win with Black Men, jumped on Zoom and raised over $1.3 million. And then right after that, there was a clarion call for white women and they used social media. They said, white women, answer the call. And so 164,000 of them did, and they crashed Zoom and raised over $8.5 million. And then, of course, you had white dudes for Kamala, South Asian women for Harris, and Latina for Harris, all of that in 1 week. So social media took over, and grassroots organizations are the reason for it.
Wow, social media then much bigger than traditional media in what they're doing to convey this message of newness or whatever you want to call it in the campaign.
Well, it really forced the media to start to cover what was happening at the grassroots level.
Well, this is Signals and Noise on the Jefferson Exchange with Mike Green and Eric Palmer. Let's move on to topic two about the Olympics, which is a different approach to covering things. NBC, for example, making everything available in real time. We watched the opening ceremonies at our house on Friday morning at 10:30. That was kind of fun. Mike, talk about what you're seeing there and what's drawing your eyeballs, if at all, to the Olympics.
We were all watching it as well. And what really struck me is that it seemed like a feature-length film was being directed in real time with no options for other takes.
Yeah, no stadium, miles of the Seine River and all the backdrops, yeah.
And the rain, and it was just cinematic. Mm-hmm. And of course, it bored my kids from the beginning, but as we neared the end, it just sort of created somewhat of a, a dramatic ending. And so I was really pleased with the way they covered it. And I just thought, how did they do that?
I'm curious to know what pulled your kids in. Was it the silver horse with the lights on the Thames in the darkness?
There was a lot of CGI, a lot of various different pieces to the puzzle. But I think the storyline carrying the torch through the city of Paris and just all the various different parts of Paris that my kids had never seen before, weren't exposed to before. And so it kind of drew their interest.
Eric, what was your take on the Olympics opening or since?
Very similar to what you and Mike have just said. I enjoyed greatly watching with my daughter the opening ceremonies. I especially appreciated the way they kind of showcased great Olympians who weren't necessarily French, and I thought that was pretty exciting and interesting. But also, it also called attention to the notion of how the public kind of engages with the Olympics. I have a Peacock subscription, and we've been enjoying all the kind of technology innovations that are available to us through that subscription. So that's been really great. But it's also worth noting that the Olympics are not exactly a private organization, private event. They're not exactly a public or governmental organization. And so, when commercial interests like NBC are able to kind of close off access to these events, which can only be held with incredible degrees of coordination with governmental and tax-supported organizations, then, that's a trend. It started, a long time. One, really key turning point was when Monday Night Football went to ESPN, and it went behind a firewall a number of years
ago. Paywall, yeah.
Or a paywall, yeah, thank you. And so, and that trend has continued, and that balance between the appropriate kind of commercialization and the public nature of these events is evolving and interesting and occasionally troubling.
Mm-hmm. Let's go on to a third topic that we'll do shortly. We've talked about struggling newspapers a couple times and had people on to talk about recent cuts at EO Media and Carpenter, formerly Pamplin Media in Oregon. But a big number came out a few days ago, which was the Oregonian taking a look at Oregon Employment Department numbers and seeing that Oregon newspapers alone have lost 3/4 of their jobs since 2001. Eric, what do you make of that and prospects for anything improving anytime soon?
Obviously, the larger trend across the state and across the nation is really troubling in terms of the availability of good journalism. I do want to call attention, again, just in the last 24 hours, one green shoot that we might see is the pending purchase of the alt-weekly newspapers, Portland Mercury and The Stranger in Seattle, by organizations that or by investors that appear to be committed to promoting and strengthening those organizations. and also doing what I think all journalists need to do, producing handcrafted local content, having scaling the enterprise through shared sales and technology platforms, and also adopting e-commerce technologies that really support and connect with local audiences. In the case of The Stranger and The Mercury, that's a ticket sales platform for music performances and cultural performances that has been a really successful venture for them.
Well, here we are sitting at a you know, listener-supported journalism entity of our own, talking about journalism and support. Mike, what's your take on three-quarters of the newspaper jobs in Oregon lost in just 23 years?
I know. I looked up the Bureau of Labor Statistics on the industry writ large, media and communications, and there's good news and bad news. The good news is that the media industry and communications industry is about to grow as fast, on average, as all other occupations through 2032, with 114,000 openings every year. The bad news is that news analysts, reporters, and journalists within that same industry is going to decline in the same time frame.
News analysts, so people who can actually figure the deeper things behind the news other than just splashing the stuff on the front page about the numbers and all that.
You got it.
Yikes. Okay, well, we have a little extra time then to move into our pick three segment. And Mike, why don't I invite you to start the pick threes off?
Okay, well, there are three things that my family are watching right now. One is a season of Receiver, and this is following the lives of four NFL receivers, Debo Samuel and George Kittle of the 49ers, Justin Jefferson of the Minnesota Vikings, and Amon-Ra St. Brown of the Lions. And because my boys are big sports fans, they're loving that. And so we just finished that. And then, of course, in Olympic style, we looked at, watched Simone Biles Rising, and it chronicles her life following the 2020 Olympics when she bowed out due to a mental disruption.
And that is a documentary about her, right?
It is. Mm-hmm.
Is that on Peacock or somebody else?
We've been watching it on Netflix.
Netflix, I believe. Okay, yeah. Yes, I'm sorry.
And, well, now she's back to her full form. And so we're so excited that we were watching that, and now we get to watch the Olympics and see her back on top. And then, of course, finally, the Bridgerton obsession.
That series. Yeah, I've been down that rabbit hole myself lately.
For those who haven't seen it, this is a series about a 19th century English royal families and their drama and their dynamics, but it has a multiracial, multicultural twist that we love.
It really, yeah, it's, and then there's a whole side series about Queen Charlotte in the Bridgerton universe that explains the multiculturalism. It actually takes some origin story in there, which is some excellent stuff. So that's Mike's pick three. Eric Palmer, what's your pick three for the month?
Sure. Obviously, it's a big weekend in comic and cultural fandom with the San Diego Comic-Con and all of the news coming out of there, especially related to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Super interesting, exciting for me. I went to the Thorns versus Rexon game in Portland last weekend, which is part of the hashtag Rex Coast tour and linked to Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhaney, the television movie actors who
they own the team, the Rexham team, yeah.
Phenomenon around Wrexham AFC in Wales, also very interesting, exciting. Also, an interesting kind of touch point for this connection between kind of culture and politics and the evolution of culture and entertainment. And then I also recently, in the last couple of weeks, reread the two published biographies of famed American portrait photographer Richard Avedon, one by Norma Stevens and one by Philip Gefter, and really appreciate those. I think Avedon is extremely famous, but also perhaps a little underappreciated for his influence on the larger culture. And I was pleased to kind of refresh my understanding of his life and work.
Some major portraits by Richard Avedon. I've seen many over the years, and his work is always kind of tinglingly impressive. Send the links, if you guys would, to your pick threes, and we'll make sure we put them up on the web for people to follow along. Mike Green is the Jefferson Exchange co-host and sitting in on the panel for this month's Signals and Noise. Mike, thanks.
This was fun.
Eric Palmer, who is the professor and chair of communication, media, and cinema at Southern Oregon University. Good to have you back on the Jefferson Exchange.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Good to have you both. And that'll do it for today's exchange. JeffExchange.org is our website. We upload all segments there into our podcasting sites like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Angela Decker of JPR News is our senior producer. Charlie Zimmerman, assistant producer. Andrew Crackle's at the controls today. Maxwell and Terry Longshore composed our theme music. I'm Jeffrey Riley with co-host Mike Green. Thanks for listening. Join us next time on the Jefferson Exchange and have a great day.